trees, these stones being a valuable royal tax. I find that when irregularly shaped stones are embedded in the roots of trees, small parcels of earth are very frequently enclosed in their interstices and behind them, so perfectly that not a particle could be washed away during the longest transport. Out of one small portion of earth thus completely enclosed by the roots of an oak about 50 years old, 3 dicotyledonous plants germinated. I am certain of the accuracy of this observation. Again, I can show that the carcasses of birds, when floating on the sea, sometimes escape being immediately devoured, and many kinds of seeds in the crops of floating birds long retain their vitality. Peas and vetches, for instance, are killed by even a few days' immersion in seawater. But some taken out of the crop of a pigeon, which had floated on artificial seawater for 30 days, to my surprise, nearly all germinated. Living birds can hardly fail to be highly effective agents in the transportation of seeds. I could give many facts showing how frequently birds of many kinds are blown by gales to vast distances across the ocean. We may safely assume that, under such circumstances, their rate of flight would often be 35 miles an hour, and some authors have given a far higher estimate. I have never seen an instance of nutritious seeds passing through the intestines of a bird. But hard seeds of fruit pass uninjured through even the digestive organs of a turkey. In the course of 2 months, I picked up in my garden 12 kinds of seeds out of the excrement of small birds, and these seemed perfect, and some of them, which were tried, germinated. But the following fact is more important. The crops of birds do not secrete gastric juice, and do not, as I know by trial, injure in the least the germination of seeds. Now, after a bird has found and devoured a large supply of food, it is positively asserted that all the grains do not pass into the gizzard for 12 or even 18 hours. A bird in this interval might easily be blown to the distance of 500 miles, and hawks are known to look out for tired birds, and the contents of their torn crops might thus readily get scattered. Some hawks and owls bolt their prey whole, and after an interval of from 12 to 20 hours, disgorge pellets which, as I know from experiments made in the zoological gardens, include seeds capable of germination. Some seeds of the oat, wheat, millet, canary, hemp, clover, and beet germinated after having been from 12 to 21 hours in the stomachs of different birds of prey. And 2 seeds of beet grew after having been thus retained for 2 days and 14 hours. Freshwater fish, I find, eat seeds of many land and water plants. Fish are frequently devoured by birds, and thus the seeds might be transported from place to place. I forced many kinds of seeds into the stomachs of dead fish, and then gave their bodies to fishing eagles, storks, and pelicans. These birds, after an interval of many hours, either rejected the seeds in pellets or passed them in their excrement. And several of these seeds retained the power of germination. Certain seeds, however, were always killed by this process. Locusts are sometimes blown to great distances from the land. I myself caught one 370 miles from the coast of Africa, and have heard of others caught at greater distances. The Reverend R. T. Lowe informed Sir C. Lyell that in November 1844, swarms of locusts visited the island of Madeira. They were in countless numbers, as thick as the flakes of snow in the heaviest snowstorm, and extended upward as far as could be seen with a telescope. During 2 or 3 days they slowly careered round and round in an immense ellipse, at least 5 or 6 miles in diameter, and at night alighted on the taller trees, which were completely coated with them. They then disappeared over the sea as suddenly as they had appeared, and have not since visited the island. Now, in parts of Natal, it is believed by some farmers, though on insufficient evidence, that injurious seeds are introduced into their grassland in the dung left by the great flights of locusts which often visit that country. In consequence of this belief, Mr. Wheel sent me in a letter a small packet of the dried pellets, out of which I extracted under the microscope several seeds, and raised from them seven grass plants belonging to two species of two genera. Hence a swarm of locusts, such as that which visited Madeira, might readily be the means of introducing several kinds of plants into an island lying far from the mainland. Although the beaks and feet of birds are generally clean, earth sometimes adheres to them. In one case I removed 61 grains, and in another case 22 grains of dry, argillaceous earth from the foot of a partridge, and in the earth there was a pebble as large as the seed of a vetch. Here is a better case. The leg of a woodcock was sent to me by a friend, with a little cake of dry earth attached to the shank, weighing only 9 grains. And this contained a seed of the toad rush, Juncus buffonius, which germinated and flowered. Mr. Swaysland of Brighton, who during the last 40 years has paid close attention to our migratory birds, informs me that he has often shot wagtails, motacillae, wheat ears and windshacks, saxicolae, on their first arrival on our shores before they had alighted, and he has several times noted little cakes of earth attached to their feet. Many facts could be given showing how generally soil is charged with seeds. For instance, Professor Newton sent me the leg of a red-legged partridge, Cacobus rufa, which had been wounded and could not fly, with a ball of hard earth adhering to it and weighing 6.5 ounces. The earth had been kept for 3 years, but when broken, watered and placed under a bell glass, no less than 82 plants sprung from it. These consisted of 12 monocotyledons, including the common oat, and at least one kind of grass, and of 70 dicotyledons, which consisted, judging from the young leaves, of at least 3 distinct species. With such facts before us, can we doubt that the many birds which are annually blown by gales across great spaces of ocean, and which annually migrate, for instance, the millions of quails across the Mediterranean, must occasionally transport a few seeds embedded in dirt adhering to their feet or beaks. But I shall have to recur to this subject. As icebergs are known to be sometimes loaded with earth and stones, and have even carried brushwood, bones, and the nest of a land bird, it can hardly be doubted that they must occasionally, as suggested by Lyell, have transported seeds from one part to another of the Arctic and Antarctic regions. And during the glacial period, from one part of the now temperate regions to another. In the Azores, from the large number of plants common to Europe, in comparison with the species on the other islands of the Atlantic, which stand nearer to the mainland, and, as remarked by Mr. H. C. Watson, from their somewhat northern character in comparison with the latitude, I suspected that these islands had been partly stocked by ice-borne seeds during the glacial epoch. At my request, Sir C. Lyell wrote to Monsieur Hartung to inquire whether he had observed erratic boulders on these islands, and he answered that he had found large fragments of granite and other rocks which do not occur in the archipelago. Hence we may safely infer that icebergs formerly landed their rocky burdens on the shores of these mid-ocean islands, and it is at least possible that they may have brought thither the seeds of northern plants. Considering that these several means of transport, and that other means which without doubt remain to be discovered, have been in action year after year for tens of thousands of years, it would, I think, be a marvellous fact if many plants had not thus become widely transported. These means of transport are sometimes called accidental, but this is not strictly correct. The currents of the sea are not accidental, nor is the direction of prevalent gales of wind. It should be observed that scarcely any means of transport would carry seeds for very great distances, for seeds do not retain their vitality when exposed for a great length of time to the action of seawater, nor could they be long carried in the crops or intestines of birds. These means, however, would suffice for occasional transport across tracts of sea some 100 miles in breadth, or from island to island, or from a continent to a neighbouring island, but not from one distant continent to another. The floras of distant continents would not by such means become mingled, but would remain as distinct as they now are. The currents, from their course, would never bring seeds from North America to Britain, though they might and do bring seeds from the West Indies to our western shores, where, if not killed by their very long immersion in salt water, they could not endure our climate. Almost every year one or two land birds are blown across the whole Atlantic Ocean from North America to the western shores of Ireland and England. But seeds could be transported by these rare wanderers only by one means, namely by dirt adhering to their feet or beaks, which is in itself a rare accident. Even in this case, how small would be the chance of a seed falling on favourable soil and coming to maturity? But it would be a great error to argue that because a well-stocked island like Great Britain has not, as far as is known, and it would be very difficult to prove this, received within the last few centuries, through occasional means of transport, immigrants from Europe or any other continent, that a poorly stocked island, though standing more remote from the mainland, would not receive colonists by similar means. Out of 100 kinds of seeds or animals transported to an island, even if far less well stocked than Britain, perhaps not more than one would be so well fitted to its new home as to become naturalized. But this is no valid argument against what would be affected by occasional means of transport during the long lapse of geological time whilst the island was being upheaved and before it had become fully stocked with inhabitants. On almost bare land, with few or no destructive insects or birds living there, nearly every seed which chanced to arrive, if fitted for the climate, would germinate and survive. Dispersal during the glacial period. The identity of many plants and animals on mountain summits separated from each other by hundreds of miles of lowlands, where alpine species could not possibly exist, is one of the most striking cases known of the same species living at distant points without the apparent possibility of their having migrated from one point to the other. It is indeed a remarkable fact to see so many plants of the same species living on the snowy regions of the Alps or Pyrenees, and in the extreme northern parts of Europe. But it is far more remarkable that the plants on the White Mountains in the United States of America are all the same with those of Labrador, and nearly all the same, as we hear from Asa Gray, with those on the loftiest mountains of Europe. Even as long ago as 1747, such facts led Gmelin to conclude that the same species must have been independently created at many distinct points, and we might have remained in this same belief had not Agassiz and others called vivid attention to the glacial period, which, as we shall immediately see, affords a simple explanation of these facts. We have evidence of almost every conceivable kind, organic and inorganic, that within a very recent geological period Central Europe and North America suffered under an Arctic climate. The ruins of a house burnt by fire do not tell their tale more plainly than do the mountains of Scotland and Wales, with their scored flanks, polished surfaces, and perched boulders, of the icy streams with which their valleys were lately filled. So greatly has the climate of Europe changed that in northern Italy gigantic moraines, left by old glaciers, are now clothed by vine and maize. Throughout a large part of the United States, erratic boulders and scored rocks plainly reveal a former cold period. The former influence of the glacial climate on the distribution of the inhabitants of Europe, as explained by Edward Forbes, is substantially as follows. But we shall follow the changes more readily by supposing a new glacial period slowly to come on, and then pass away, as formerly occurred. As the cold came on, and as each more southern zone became fitted for the inhabitants of the north, these would take the places of the former inhabitants of the temperate regions. The latter, at the same time, would travel further and further southward, unless they were stopped by barriers, in which case they would perish. The mountains would become covered with snow and ice, and their former alpine inhabitants would descend to the plains. By the time that the cold had reached its maximum, we should have an Arctic fauna and flora covering the central parts of Europe as far south as the Alps and Pyrenees, and even stretching into Spain. The now temperate regions of the United States would likewise be covered by Arctic plants and animals, and these would be nearly the same with those of Europe. For the present circumpolar inhabitants, which we suppose to have everywhere travelled southward, are remarkably uniform round the world. As the warmth returned, the Arctic forms would retreat northward, closely followed up in their retreat by the productions of the more temperate regions. And as the snow melted from the bases of the mountains, the Arctic forms would seize on the cleared and thawed ground, always ascending as the warmth increased and the snow still further disappeared, higher and higher, whilst their brethren were pursuing their northern journey. Hence, when the warmth had fully returned, the same species which had lately lived together on the European and North American lowlands would again be found in the Arctic regions of the Old and New Worlds, and on many isolated mountain summits far distant from each other. Thus we can understand the identity of many plants at points so immensely remote as the mountains of the United States and those of Europe. We can thus also understand the fact that the alpine plants of each mountain range are more especially related to the Arctic forms living due north, or nearly due north of them. For the first migration when the cold came on, and the remigration on the returning warmth, would generally have been due south and north. The alpine plants, for example, of Scotland, as remarked by Mr. H. C. Watson, and those of the Pyrenees, as remarked by Ramond, are more especially allied to the plants of northern Scandinavia, those of the United States to Labrador, those of the mountains of Siberia to the Arctic regions of that country. These views, grounded as they are on the perfectly well-ascertained occurrence of a former glacial period, seem to me to explain in so satisfactory a manner the present distribution of the alpine and Arctic productions of Europe and America, that when in other regions we find the same species on distant mountain summits, we may almost conclude, without other evidence, that a colder climate formerly permitted their migration across the intervening lowlands now become too warm for their existence. As the Arctic forms moved first southward and afterwards backward to the north, in unison with the changing climate, they will not have been exposed during their long migrations to any great diversity of temperature. And as they all migrated in a body together, their mutual relations will not have been much disturbed. Hence, in accordance with the principles inculcated in this volume, these forms will not have been liable to much modification. But with the alpine productions, left isolated from the moment of the returning warmth, first at the bases and ultimately on the summits of the mountains, the case will have been somewhat different. For it is not likely that all the same Arctic species will have been left on mountain ranges far distant from each other and have survived there ever since. They will also, in all probability, have become mingled with ancient alpine species which must have existed on the mountains before the commencement of the glacial epoch, and which, during the coldest period, will have been temporarily driven down to the plains. They will also have been subsequently exposed to somewhat different climatical influences. Their mutual relations will thus have been in some degree disturbed. Consequently, they will have been liable to modification. And they have been modified. For if we compare the present alpine plants and animals of the several great European mountain ranges, one with another, though many of the species remain identically the same, some exist as varieties, some as doubtful forms or subspecies, and some as distinct yet closely allied species representing each other on the several ranges. In the foregoing illustration, I have assumed that at the commencement of our imaginary glacial period, the Arctic productions were as uniform round the polar regions as they are at the present day. But it is also necessary to assume that many subarctic and some few temperate forms were the same round the world, for some of the species which now exist on the lower mountain slopes and on the plains of North America and Europe are the same. And it may be asked how I account for this degree of uniformity of the subarctic and temperate forms round the world at the commencement of the real glacial period. At the present day, the subarctic and northern temperate productions of the Old and New Worlds are separated from each other by the whole Atlantic Ocean and by the northern part of the Pacific. During the glacial period, when the inhabitants of the Old and New Worlds lived further southwards than they do at present, they must have been still more completely separated from each other by wider spaces of ocean, so that it may well be asked how the same species could then or previously have entered the two continents. The explanation, I believe, lies in the nature of the climate before the commencement of the glacial period. At this, the newer Pliocene period, the majority of the inhabitants of the world were specifically the same as now, and we have good reason to believe that the climate was warmer than at the present day. Hence we may suppose that the organisms which now live under latitude 60 degrees lived during the Pliocene period further north, under the polar circle in latitude 66 to 67 degrees, and that the present Arctic productions then lived on the broken land still nearer to the pole. Now, if we look at a terrestrial globe, we see under the polar circle that there is almost continuous land from Western Europe through Siberia to Eastern America. And this continuity of the circumpolar land, with the consequent freedom under a more favourable climate for intermigration, will account for the supposed uniformity of the subarctic and temperate productions of the Old and New Worlds at a period anterior to the glacial epoch. Believing, from reasons before alluded to, that our continents have long remained in nearly the same relative position, though subjected to great oscillations of level, I am strongly inclined to extend the above view and to infer that during some earlier and still warmer period, such as the older Pliocene period, a large number of the same plants and animals inhabited the almost continuous circumpolar land, and that these plants and animals, both in the Old and New Worlds, began slowly to migrate southwards as the climate became less warm, long before the commencement of the glacial period. We now see, as I believe, their descendants, mostly in a modified condition, in the central parts of Europe and the United States. On this view, we can understand the relationship with very little identity between the productions of North America and Europe, a relationship which is highly remarkable considering the distance of the two areas and their separation by the whole Atlantic Ocean. We can further understand the singular fact remarked on by several observers that the productions of Europe and America during the later tertiary stages were more closely related to each other than they are at the present time. For during these warmer periods, the northern parts of the Old and New Worlds will have been almost continuously united by land, serving as a bridge, since rendered impassable by cold, for the intermigration of their inhabitants. During the slowly decreasing warmth of the Pliocene period, as soon as the species in common which inhabited the New and Old Worlds migrated south of the polar circle, they will have been completely cut off from each other. This separation, as far as the more temperate productions are concerned, must have taken place long ages ago. As the plants and animals migrated southward, they will have become mingled in the one great region with the Native American productions, and would have had to compete with them, and in the other great region with those of the Old World. Consequently, we have here everything favourable for much modification, for far more modification than with the Alpine productions, left isolated within a much more recent period on the several mountain ranges and on the Arctic lands of Europe and North America. Hence it has come that when we compare the now living productions of the temperate regions of the New and Old Worlds, we find very few identical species, though Asa Gray has lately shown that more plants are identical than was formerly supposed. But we find in every great class many forms which some naturalists rank as geographical races and others as distinct species, and a host of closely allied or representative forms which are ranked by all naturalists as specifically distinct. As on the land, so in the waters of the sea, a slow southern migration of a marine fauna, which during the Pliocene or even a somewhat earlier period was nearly uniform along the continuous shores of the polar circle, will account, on the theory of modification, for many closely allied forms now living in marine areas completely sundered. Thus I think we can understand the presence of some closely allied, still existing and extinct tertiary forms on the eastern and western shores of temperate North America, and the still more striking fact of many closely allied crustaceans, as described in Dana's admirable work, some fish and other marine animals inhabiting the Mediterranean and the seas of Japan, these two areas being now completely separated by the breadth of a whole continent and by wide spaces of ocean. These cases of close relationship in species either now or formerly inhabiting the seas on the eastern and western shores of North America, the Mediterranean and Japan, and the temperate lands of North America and Europe, are inexplicable on the theory of creation. We cannot maintain that such species have been created alike in correspondence with the nearly similar physical conditions of the areas. For if we compare, for instance, certain parts of South America with parts of South Africa or Australia, we see countries closely similar in all their physical conditions, with their inhabitants utterly dissimilar. Alternate glacial periods in the north and south. But we must return to our more immediate subject. I am convinced that Forbes's view may be largely extended. In Europe, we meet with the plainest evidence of the glacial period from the western shores of Britain to the Ural Range and southward to the Pyrenees. We may infer from the frozen mammals and nature of the mountain vegetation that Siberia was similarly affected. In the Lebanon, according to Dr. Hooker, perpetual snow formerly covered the central axis and fed glaciers which rolled 4,000 feet down the valleys. The same observer has recently found great moraines at a low level on the Atlas Range in North Africa. Along the Himalaya, at points 900 miles apart, glaciers have left the marks of their former low descent. And in Sikkim, Dr. Hooker saw maize growing on ancient and gigantic moraines. Southward of the Asiatic continent, on the opposite side of the equator, we know from the excellent researches of Dr. J. Haast and Dr. Hector that in New Zealand immense glaciers formerly descended to a low level. And the same plants found by Dr. Hooker on widely separated mountains in this island tell the same story of a former cold period. From facts communicated to me by the Reverend W.B. Clark, it appears also that there are traces of former glacial action on the mountains of the southeastern corner of Australia. Looking to America. In the northern half, ice-borne fragments of rock have been observed on the eastern side of the continent as far south as latitude 36 and 37 degrees, and on the shores of the Pacific, where the climate is now so different, as far south as latitude 46 degrees. Erratic boulders have also been noticed on the Rocky Mountains. In the Cordillera of South America, nearly under the equator, glaciers once extended far below their present level. In central Chile, I examined a vast mound of detritus with great boulders crossing the Portillo Valley, which, there can hardly be a doubt, once formed a huge moraine. And Mr. D. Forbes informs me that he found in various parts of the Cordillera, from latitude 13 to 30 degrees south at about the height of 12,000 feet, deeply furrowed rocks, resembling those with which he was familiar in Norway, and likewise great masses of detritus, including grooved pebbles. Along this whole space of the Cordillera, true glaciers do not now exist, even at much more considerable heights. Further south, on both sides of the continent, from latitude 41 degrees to the southernmost extremity, we have the clearest evidence of former glacial action in numerous immense boulders transported far from their parent source. From these several facts, namely from the glacial action having extended all round the northern and southern hemispheres, from the period having been in a geological sense recent in both hemispheres, from its having lasted in both during a great length of time, as may be inferred from the amount of work effected, and lastly, from glaciers having recently descended to a low level along the whole line of the Cordillera, it at one time appeared to me that we could not avoid the conclusion that the temperature of the whole world had been simultaneously lowered during the glacial period. But now Mr. Kroll, in a series of admirable memoirs, has attempted to show that a glacial condition of climate is the result of various physical causes brought into operation by an increase in the eccentricity of the Earth's orbit. All these causes tend towards the same end, but the most powerful appears to be the indirect influence of the eccentricity of the orbit upon oceanic currents. According to Mr. Kroll, cold periods regularly recur every 10 or 15,000 years. And these, at long intervals, are extremely severe, owing to certain contingencies of which the most important, as Sir C. Lyell has shown, is the relative position of the land and water. Mr. Kroll believes that the last great glacial period occurred about 240,000 years ago and endured, with slight alterations of climate, for about 160,000 years. With respect to more ancient glacial periods, several geologists are convinced from direct evidence that such occurred during the Miocene and Eocene formations, not to mention still more ancient formations. But the most important result for us, arrived at by Mr. Kroll, is that whenever the northern hemisphere passes through a cold period, the temperature of the southern hemisphere is actually raised, with the winters rendered much milder, chiefly through changes in the direction of the ocean currents. So, conversely, it will be with the northern hemisphere, while the southern passes through a glacial period. This conclusion throws so much light on geographical distribution that I am strongly inclined to trust it. But I will first give the facts which demand an explanation. In South America, Dr. Hooker has shown that besides many closely allied species, between 40 and 50 of the flowering plants of Tierra del Fuego, forming no inconsiderable part of its scanty flora, are common to North America and Europe, enormously remote as these areas in opposite hemispheres are from each other. On the lofty mountains of equatorial America, a host of peculiar species belonging to European genera occur. On the Organ Mountains of Brazil, some few temperate European, some Antarctic, and some Andean genera were found by Gardner, which do not exist in the low intervening hot countries. On the Silla of Caracas, the illustrious Humboldt long ago found species belonging to genera characteristic of the Cordillera. In Africa, several forms characteristic of Europe, and some few representatives of the flora of the Cape of Good Hope, occur on the mountains of Abyssinia. At the Cape of Good Hope, a very few European species believed not to have been introduced by man, and on the mountains several representative European forms are found which have not been discovered in the intertropical parts of Africa. Dr. Hooker has also lately shown that several of the plants living on the upper parts of the lofty island of Fernando Po and on the neighbouring Cameroon Mountains in the Gulf of Guinea are closely related to those on the mountains of Abyssinia, and likewise to those of temperate Europe. It now also appears, as I hear from Dr. Hooker, that some of these same temperate plants have been discovered by the Reverend R. T. Lowe on the mountains of the Cape Verde Islands. This extension of the same temperate forms, almost under the equator, across the whole continent of Africa and to the mountains of the Cape Verde archipelago, is one of the most astonishing facts ever recorded in the distribution of plants. On the Himalaya, and on the isolated mountain ranges of the peninsula of India, on the heights of Ceylon, and on the volcanic cones of Java, many plants occur either identically the same or representing each other, and at the same time representing plants of Europe not found in the intervening hot lowlands. A list of the genera of plants collected on the loftier peaks of Java raises a picture of a collection made on a hillock in Europe. Still more striking is the fact that peculiar Australian forms are represented by certain plants growing on the summits of the mountains of Borneo. Some of these Australian forms, as I hear from Dr. Hooker, extend along the heights of the peninsula of Malacca and are thinly scattered on the one hand over India and on the other hand as far north as Japan. On the southern mountains of Australia, Dr. F. Muller has discovered several European species. Other species not introduced by man occur on the lowlands, and a long list can be given, as I am informed by Dr. Hooker, of European genera found in Australia but not in the intermediate torrid regions. In the admirable Introduction to the Flora of New Zealand by Dr. Hooker, analogous and striking facts are given in regard to the plants of that large island. Hence we see that certain plants growing on the more lofty mountains of the tropics in all parts of the world, and on the temperate plains of the north and south, are either the same species or varieties of the same species. It should, however, be observed that these plants are not strictly Arctic forms, for, as Mr. H. C. Watson has remarked, In receding from polar toward equatorial latitudes, the alpine or mountain flora really become less and less arctic. Besides these identical and closely allied forms, many species inhabiting the same widely sundered areas belong to genera not now found in the intermediate tropical lowlands. These brief remarks apply to plants alone, but some few analogous facts could be given in regard to terrestrial animals. In marine productions, similar cases likewise occur. As an example, I may quote a statement by the highest authority, Professor Dana, that it is certainly a wonderful fact that New Zealand should have a closer resemblance in its crustacea to Great Britain, its antipode, than to any other part of the world. Sir J. Richardson also speaks of the reappearance on the shores of New Zealand, Tasmania, etc., of northern forms of fish. Dr. Hooker informs me that 25 species of algae are common to New Zealand and to Europe, but have not been found in the intermediate tropical seas. From the foregoing facts, namely the presence of temperate forms on the highlands across the whole of equatorial Africa, and along the peninsula of India to Ceylon and the Malay archipelago, and in a less well-marked manner across the wide expanse of tropical South America, it appears almost certain that at some former period, no doubt during the most severe part of a glacial period, the lowlands of these great continents were everywhere tenanted under the equator by a considerable number of temperate forms. At this period, the equatorial climate at the level of the sea was probably about the same with that now experienced at the height of from 5,000 to 6,000 feet under the same latitude, or perhaps even rather cooler. During this, the coldest period, the lowlands under the equator must have been clothed with a mingled tropical and temperate vegetation, like that described by Hooker as growing luxuriantly at the height of from 4,000 to 5,000 feet on the lower slopes of the Himalaya, but with perhaps a still greater preponderance of temperate forms. So again, in the mountainous island of Fernando Po in the Gulf of Guinea, Mr. Mann found temperate European forms beginning to appear at the height of about 5,000 feet. On the mountains of Panama, at the height of only 2,000 feet, Dr. Seaman found the vegetation like that of Mexico, with forms of the torrid zone harmoniously blended with those of the temperate. Now let us see whether Mr. Kroll's conclusion that when the northern hemisphere suffered from the extreme cold of the Great Glacial Period, the southern hemisphere was actually warmer, throws any clear light on the present, apparently inexplicable distribution of various organisms in the temperate parts of both hemispheres and on the mountains of the tropics. The glacial period, as measured by years, must have been very long, and when we remember over what vast spaces some naturalized plants and animals have spread within a few centuries, this period will have been ample for any amount of migration. As the cold became more and more intense, we know that Arctic forms invaded the temperate regions, and from the facts just given, there can hardly be a doubt that some of the more vigorous, dominant, and widest spreading temperate forms invaded the equatorial lowlands. The inhabitants of these hot lowlands would at the same time have migrated to the tropical and subtropical regions of the south, for the southern hemisphere was at this period warmer. On the decline of the glacial period, as both hemispheres gradually recovered their former temperature, the northern temperate forms living on the lowlands under the equator would have been driven to their former homes, or have been destroyed, being replaced by the equatorial forms returning from the south. Some, however, of the northern temperate forms would almost certainly have ascended any adjoining highland, where, if sufficiently lofty, they would have long survived, like the Arctic forms on the mountains of Europe. They might have survived even if the climate was not perfectly fitted for them, for the change of temperature must have been very slow, and plants undoubtedly possess a certain capacity for acclimatization, as shown by their transmitting to their offspring different constitutional powers of resisting heat and cold. In the regular course of events, the southern hemisphere would in its turn be subjected to a severe glacial period, with the northern hemisphere rendered warmer, and then the southern temperate forms would invade the equatorial lowlands. The northern forms, which had before been left on the mountains, would now descend and mingle with the southern forms. These latter, when the warmth returned, would return to their former homes, leaving some few species on the mountains, and carrying southward with them some of the northern temperate forms which had descended from their mountain fastnesses. Thus we should have had some few species identically the same in the northern and southern temperate zones, and on the mountains of the intermediate tropical regions. But the species left during a long time on these mountains, or in opposite hemispheres, would have to compete with many new forms, and would be exposed to somewhat different physical conditions. Hence they would be eminently liable to modification, and would generally now exist as varieties, or as representative species. And this is the case. We must also bear in mind the occurrence in both hemispheres of former glacial periods, for these will account, in accordance with the same principles, for the many quite distinct species inhabiting the same widely separated areas and belonging to genera not now found in the intermediate torrid zones. It is a remarkable fact, strongly insisted on by Hooker in regard to America and by Alphonse de Candolle in regard to Australia, that many more identical or slightly modified species have migrated from the north to the south than in a reversed direction. We see, however, a few southern forms on the mountains of Borneo and Abyssinia. I suspect that this preponderant migration from the north to the south is due to the greater extent of land in the north, and to the northern forms having existed in their own homes in greater numbers, and having consequently been advanced through natural selection and competition to a higher stage of perfection or dominating power than the southern forms. And thus, when the two sets became commingled in the equatorial regions during the alternations of the glacial periods, the northern forms were the more powerful and were able to hold their places on the mountains, and afterwards migrate southward with the southern forms. But not so the southern in regard to the northern forms. In the same manner, at the present day we see that very many European productions cover the ground in La Plata, New Zealand, and to a lesser degree in Australia, and have beaten the natives. Whereas extremely few southern forms have become naturalized in any part of the northern hemisphere, though hides, wool, and other objects likely to carry seeds have been largely imported into Europe during the last 2 or 3 centuries from La Plata, and during the last 40 or 50 years from Australia. The Nilgiri Mountains in India, however, offer a partial exception, for here, as I hear from Dr. Hooker, Australian forms are rapidly sowing themselves and becoming naturalized. Before the last great glacial period, no doubt the intertropical mountains were stocked with endemic alpine forms, but these have almost everywhere yielded to the more dominant forms generated in the larger areas and more efficient workshops of the north. In many islands, the native productions are nearly equaled or even outnumbered by those which have become naturalized, and this is the first stage towards their extinction. Mountains are islands on the land, and their inhabitants have yielded to those produced within the larger areas of the north, just in the same way as the inhabitants of real islands have everywhere yielded, and are still yielding, to continental forms naturalized through man's agency. The same principles apply to the distribution of terrestrial animals and of marine productions in the northern and southern temperate zones and on the intertropical mountains. When, during the height of the glacial period, the ocean currents were widely different to what they are now, some of the inhabitants of the temperate seas might have reached the equator. Of these, a few would perhaps at once be able to migrate southwards by keeping to the cooler currents, while others might remain and survive in the colder depths until the southern hemisphere was in its turn subjected to a glacial climate and permitted their further progress. In nearly the same manner as, according to Forbes, isolated spaces inhabited by Arctic productions exist to the present day in the deeper parts of the northern temperate seas. I am far from supposing that all the difficulties in regard to the distribution and affinities of the identical and allied species, which now live so widely separated in the north and south, and sometimes on the intermediate mountain ranges, are removed on the views above given. The exact lines of migration cannot be indicated. We cannot say why certain species and not others have migrated. Why certain species have been modified and have given rise to new forms, while others have remained unaltered. We cannot hope to explain such facts until we can say why one species and not another becomes naturalized by man's agency in a foreign land. Why one species ranges twice or thrice as far, and is twice or thrice as common as another species within their own homes. Various special difficulties also remain to be solved. For instance, the occurrence, as shown by Dr. Hooker, of the same plants at points so enormously remote as Kerguelen Land, New Zealand, and Fuegia. But icebergs, as suggested by Lyell, may have been concerned in their dispersal. The existence at these and other distant points of the southern hemisphere of species which, though distinct, belong to genera exclusively confined to the south, is a more remarkable case. Some of these species are so distinct that we cannot suppose that there has been time since the commencement of the last glacial period for their migration and subsequent modification to the necessary degree. The facts seem to indicate that distinct species belonging to the same genera have migrated in radiating lines from a common centre, and I am inclined to look in the southern, as in the northern hemisphere, to a former and warmer period before the commencement of the last glacial period, when the Antarctic lands, now covered with ice, supported a highly peculiar and isolated flora. It may be suspected that before this flora was exterminated during the last glacial epoch, a few forms had been already widely dispersed to various points of the southern hemisphere by occasional means of transport, and by the aid as halting places of now sunken islands. Thus the southern shores of America, Australia, and New Zealand may have become slightly tinted by the same peculiar forms of life. Sir C. Lyell, in a striking passage, has speculated in language almost identical with mine on the effects of great alternations of climate throughout the world on geographical distribution. And we have now seen that Mr. Kroll's conclusion that successive glacial periods in the one hemisphere coincide with warmer periods in the opposite hemisphere, together with the admission of the slow modification of species, explains a multitude of facts in the distribution of the same and of the allied forms of life in all parts of the globe. The living waters have flowed during one period from the north and during another from the south, and in both cases have reached the equator. But the stream of life has flowed with greater force from the north than in the opposite direction, and has consequently more freely inundated the south. As the tide leaves its drift in horizontal lines, rising higher on the shores where the tide rises highest, so have the living waters left their living drift on our mountain summits, in a line gently rising from the Arctic lowlands to a great latitude under the equator. The various beings thus left stranded may be compared with savage races of man, driven up and surviving in the mountain fastnesses of almost every land, which serves as a record, full of interest to us, of the former inhabitants of the surrounding lowlands. Chapter 13. Geographical Distribution, Continued. Freshwater Productions. As lakes and river systems are separated from each other by barriers of land, it might have been thought that freshwater productions would not have ranged widely within the same country, and as the sea is apparently a still more formidable barrier, that they would never have extended to distant countries. But the case is exactly the reverse. Not only have many freshwater species belonging to different classes an enormous range, but allied species prevail in a remarkable manner throughout the world. When first collecting in the freshwaters of Brazil, I well remember feeling much surprise at the similarity of the freshwater insects, shells, etc., and at the dissimilarity of the surrounding terrestrial beings compared with those of Britain. But the wide-ranging power of freshwater productions can, I think, in most cases be explained by their having become fitted, in a manner highly useful to them, for short and frequent migrations from pond to pond, or from stream to stream within their own countries. And liability to wide dispersal would follow from this capacity as an almost necessary consequence. We can here consider only a few cases. Of these, some of the most difficult to explain are presented by fish. It was formerly believed that the same freshwater species never existed on two continents distant from each other. But Dr. Gunter has lately shown that the Galaxias attenuatus inhabits Tasmania, New Zealand, the Falkland Islands, and the mainland of South America. This is a wonderful case, and probably indicates dispersal from an Antarctic centre during a former warm period. This case, however, is rendered in some degree less surprising by the species of this genus having the power of crossing by some unknown means considerable spaces of open ocean. Thus there is one species common to New Zealand and to the Auckland Islands, though separated by a distance of about 230 miles. On the same continent, freshwater fish often range widely and as if capriciously, for in two adjoining river systems some of the species may be the same and some wholly different. It is probable that they are occasionally transported by what may be called accidental means. Thus, fishes still alive are not very rarely dropped at distant points by whirlwinds, and it is known that the ova retain their vitality for a considerable time after removal from the water. Their dispersal may, however, be mainly attributed to changes in the level of the land within the recent period, causing rivers to flow into each other. Instances also could be given of this having occurred during floods without any change of level. The wide differences of the fish on the opposite sides of most mountain ranges, which are continuous and consequently must from an early period, have completely prevented the inosculation of the river systems on the two sides, leads to the same conclusion. Some freshwater fish belong to very ancient forms, and in such cases there will have been ample time for great geographical changes, and consequently time and means for much migration. Moreover, Dr. Gunther has recently been led by several considerations to infer that with fishes, the same forms have a long endurance. Saltwater fish can with care be slowly accustomed to live in freshwater, and according to Valenciennes, there is hardly a single group of which all the members are confined to freshwater, so that a marine species belonging to a freshwater group might travel far along the shores of the sea, and could, it is probable, become adapted without much difficulty to the freshwaters of a distant land. Some species of freshwater shells have very wide ranges, and allied species, which on our theory are descended from a common parent, and must have proceeded from a single source, prevail throughout the world. Their distribution at first perplexed me much, as their ova are not likely to be transported by birds, and the ova as well as the adults are immediately killed by seawater. I could not even understand how some naturalized species have spread rapidly throughout the same country. But two facts which I have observed, and many others no doubt will be discovered, throw some light on this subject. When ducks suddenly emerge from a pond covered with duckweed, I have twice seen these little plants adhering to their backs. And it has happened to me in removing a little duckweed from one aquarium to another that I have unintentionally stocked the one with freshwater shells from the other. But another agency is perhaps more effectual. I suspended the feet of a duck in an aquarium where many ova of freshwater shells were hatching, and I found that numbers of the extremely minute and just hatched shells crawled on the feet and clung to them so firmly that when taken out of the water they could not be jarred off, though at a somewhat more advanced age they would voluntarily drop off. These just-hatched mollusks, though aquatic in their nature, survived on the duck's feet in damp air from 12 to 20 hours, and in this length of time a duck or heron might fly at least 600 or 700 miles, and if blown across the sea to an oceanic island or to any other distant point, would be sure to alight on a pool or rivulet. Sir Charles Lyell informs me that a Deiticus has been caught with an ankylis, a freshwater shell like a limpet, firmly adhering to it. And a water beetle of the same family, a Colymbetes, once flew on board the Beagle when 45 miles distant from the nearest land. How much farther it might have been blown by a favouring gale, no one can tell. With respect to plants, it has long been known what enormous ranges many freshwater and even marsh species have, both over continents and to the most remote oceanic islands. This is strikingly illustrated, according to Alphonse de Condol, in those large groups of terrestrial plants which have very few aquatic members, for the latter seem immediately to acquire, as if in consequence, a wide range. I think favourable means of dispersal explain this fact. I have before mentioned that earth occasionally adheres in some quantity to the feet and beaks of birds. Wading birds, which frequent the muddy edges of ponds, if suddenly flushed, would be the most likely to have muddy feet. Birds of this order wander more than those of any other, and are occasionally found on the most remote and barren islands of the open ocean. They would not be likely to alight on the surface of the sea, so that any dirt on their feet would not be washed off, and when gaining the land they would be sure to fly to their natural freshwater haunts. I do not believe that botanists are aware how charged the mud of ponds is with seeds. I have tried several little experiments, but will here give only the most striking case. I took in February 3 tablespoonsful of mud from 3 different points beneath water on the edge of a little pond. This mud, when dry, weighed only 6¾ ounces. I kept it covered up in my study for 6 months, pulling up and counting each plant as it grew. The plants were of many kinds, and were altogether 537 in number. And yet the viscid mud was all contained in a breakfast cup. Considering these facts, I think it would be an inexplicable circumstance if water birds did not transport the seeds of freshwater plants to unstocked ponds and streams situated at very distant points. The same agency may have come into play with the eggs of some of the smaller freshwater animals. Other and unknown agencies probably have also played a part. I have stated that freshwater fish eat some kinds of seeds, though they reject many other kinds after having swallowed them. Even small fish swallow seeds of moderate size, as of the yellow water lily and potamogeton. Herons and other birds, century after century, have gone on daily devouring fish. They then take flight and go to other waters, or are blown across the sea. And we have seen that seeds retain their power of germination when rejected many hours afterwards in pellets or in the excrement. When I saw the great size of the seeds of that fine water lily, the Nelumbium, and remembered Alphonse de Condol's remarks on the distribution of this plant, I thought that the means of its dispersal must remain inexplicable. But Audubon states that he found the seeds of the great southern water lily, probably, according to Dr. Hooker, the Nelumbium luteum, in a heron's stomach. Now this bird must often have flown with its stomach thus well stocked to distant ponds, and then getting a hearty meal of fish, analogy makes me believe that it would have rejected the seeds in the pellet in a fit state for germination. In considering these several means of distribution, it should be remembered that when a pond or stream is first formed, for instance on a rising islet, it will be unoccupied, and a single seed or egg will have a good chance of succeeding. Although there will always be a struggle for life between the inhabitants of the same pond, however few in kind, yet as the number even in a well-stocked pond is small in comparison with the number of species inhabiting an equal area of land, the competition between them will probably be less severe than between terrestrial species. Consequently, an intruder from the waters of a foreign country would have a better chance of seizing on a new place than in the case of terrestrial colonists. We should also remember that many freshwater productions are low in the scale of nature, and we have reason to believe that such beings become modified more slowly than the high. And this will give time for the migration of aquatic species. We should not forget the probability of many freshwater forms having formerly ranged continuously over immense areas, and then having become extinct at intermediate points. but the wide distribution of freshwater plants and of the lower animals, whether retaining the same identical form or in some degree modified, apparently depends in main part on the wide dispersal of their seeds and eggs by animals, more especially by freshwater birds, which have great powers of flight and natural